Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll have an update on the unfolding unrest in Bolivia, where hundreds of police and army troops took over that country's coca-growing region earlier in the week. At least seven people have been killed in the unrest, which has its roots in the government's eradication program of coca plants and the dire economic conditions facing Bolivian workers. We'll hear from the director of the Andean Information Network based in Bolivia. Later in the program, we'll take a look back at the dirty war in Argentina. Last month marked the 22nd anniversary of the military coup that brought to power one of Latin America's most brutal dictatorships. We'll first have a profile report about one of Argentina's most visible human rights organizations. Then we'll hear part one of an interview with the author of a new book about the dirty war in Argentina called Lexicon of Terror. All of this and more coming up next. But first, here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal. In Chile, a legislative commission voted 5-2 to banish General Augusto Pinochet from the Senator for Life post, which he assumed March 10th. The move is only a recommendation. Impeachment must be approved by the plenary of the lower house of Congress. The House agreed to a petition by pro-Pinochet right-wing lawmakers to make the vote secret, allowing members to skirt individual accountability and increasing chances of its being defeated. Even if the House passes the impeachment and it moves to the Senate, however, chances are good that it will be defeated there, where a strongly pro-Pinochet clique holds the majority. Pinochet's foes say a man who shut down Congress after taking power in a coup has no place in the legislature.
President Fidel Castro is praising as, quote, objective and serious, a Pentagon assessment that Cuba's armed forces are no longer a threat beyond the Caribbean island's shores. But he also lampooned as, quote, crazy, U.S. fears in the past that Cuba had represented a military threat to its giant northern neighbor. Castro said the Pentagon study was, quote, an objective report made by serious people, but Cuba has never constituted a threat to Washington, except in the moral sphere, end quote. As we reported last week, U.S. media reports have quoted a classified Pentagon draft summary as rating Cuba's military threat as severely diminished, due largely to shortages of fuel and spare parts since the breakup of the Soviet Union. The report has not been officially released. Castro insisted, however, that Cuba was still ready to defend itself against invaders, as it did during the rout of a CIA-sponsored force, which landed at the Bay of Pigs in 1961.
Colombia's largest guerrilla force is inviting United States counter-drug officials to visit areas where the rebels operate in order to understand the nature of the situation and dispel the myths of the so-called narco-guerrilla. Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia commander Raul Reyes said the FARC, F-A-R-C, is ready to show U.S. officials where the coca plantations and laboratories are to discount once and for all the accusations that they are protecting the drug trade. Reyes said this would be a first step in trying to convince the U.S. that the aid that it's shipping to Colombia's military to fight guerrillas and drug traffickers would be better spent on improving rural schools and developing local economies.
Also in Colombia, Colombian President Ernesto Samper is denying a report published in Buenos Aires on April 3rd about an alleged invasion force that is supposedly being prepared by the United States and Argentina to enter Colombia. In a communique, Samper called the report absolutely unfounded. The communique said that after learning about the report, the president met several of his advisors to study the situation and confirmed that the report is false.
And finally, in Colombia, five former army and police officials have been sentenced to 18 years in prison each for their involvement in the 1988 Segovia massacre of at least 43 people. The case is thought to be the first in which any military officers have been convicted of crimes connected to death squads.
Hundreds of Mexican police and soldiers raided homes in the southern state of Chiapas on April 8th, searching for illegal weapons. The Attorney General's office said eight people were arrested, numerous guns seized, and 20 stolen cars recovered after a six-hour operation in the highland town of La Hormiga, just outside of San Cristobal de las Casas. Sources in the Attorney General's office said the raids were prompted by the recent detention of three people in the area, found to be carrying grenade launchers and ammunition. Locals complained of heavy-handed treatment. Church and human rights groups say the government is failing to disarm paramilitary groups backed by local PRI officials, which are sowing terror in the state's indigenous communities, a charge Mexico City denies. Police say a local ruling party official was among those arrested.
In Brazil, violence against the landless peasant movement and its leaders continues to escalate. Sadi Padilla, a leader of the Landless Rural Workers Movement, or MST, was shot and killed on Palm Sunday as he was leaving church. He is the third MST leader killed within less than 15 days. The MST agitates for land reform by organizing occupations of unused land by landless and homeless families. The other two leaders were shot on March 26th during the evacuation of an occupied farm in the Amazon state of Pará. Padilla was shot in Santa Catarina State, 460 miles southeast of Rio de Janeiro. Agrarian reform is a major issue in Brazil, where the poorest 40% owns just 1% of the land. Officials admit that the disparity is a major cause of Brazil's chronic rural violence.
Paraguay's ruling party is insisting that the upcoming general election should be postponed because of massive voter registration fraud. Lawyers for the ruling Colorado Party say they have evidence that almost half of the 2.3 million voter registrations recorded are false. President Juan Carlos Wasmosy announced on April 3rd that he was prepared to lead, quote, hordes of his supporters to prevent the May 10th presidential elections from occurring. Wasmosy's statements came after Paraguay's Supreme Court rejected an attempt to have former General Lino Oviedo removed as the party's official presidential candidate. Oviedo, who was in jail for heading a coup attempt against Wasmosy in 1996, infuriated the president by winning the Colorado Party's presidential nomination last fall. Oviedo is now set to become the first man in Paraguayan history to run for president from jail.
In Peru, police are still baffled about a motive for the April 7th murder of radio journalist Isabel Chumpitas. Chumpitas was known as a champion of farmers' rights in the northern town of Piura. Her daily program, The People's Voice, often broadcast villagers and farmers calling in complaints against the regional and local governments. Chumpitas and her husband were killed when 12 armed assailants burst into their home. After being asked to identify herself, Chumpitas and her husband were beaten and shot to death. Peru, along with Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, and Guatemala, is one of the most dangerous places for journalists in Latin America, according to the Brussels-based International Federation of Journalists. The 1997 murders of two provincial Peruvian journalists also remain unsolved.
And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week for Our Americas. I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
Listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean, I'm Mario Murillo. In other news this week, the unrest in Bolivia continues. On April 8th, Bolivian unions broke off negotiations to end a general strike in which at least 7 people have died. Unions said they would not continue the talks to end the week-old strike after government negotiators refused to accept the leader of Bolivia's peasant coca leaf growers at the negotiating table. Milton Gomez, the leader of the CAB Labor Federation in Bolivia, said that in reality it's the government that's breaking off the dialogue by rejecting the presence of Evo Morales, the head of the Coca Growers Union. The CAB announced that union leaders will begin a hunger strike on Monday in pursuit of their demands, which include higher wages and continued financial aid for coca growers to switch to other legal crops. Morales called the decision to keep him out of the dialogue blackmail and promised to prove his accusations that President Hugo Banzer has links to drug traffickers, something the president denies. Meanwhile, security forces have stepped up their presence in the Chapare region and forcefully ended a week-old blockade by protesters of Bolivia's main highway between Cochabamba and Santa Cruz. Joining us now on the line to update us on the situation is Lee Cridland, who is the coordinator of the Andean Information Network based in Cochabamba, Bolivia. We're also joined by Leslie Gill, who is a professor of anthropology at American University and the author of the book Precarious Dependencies. To begin with, Lee, maybe you can give us an update. What is the situation on the ground right now in Bolivia?
Well, the zone of Chapare is completely militarized. They have managed the between a number of different types of security forces within the last 2 days to remove all of the blockades that the peasants had put in place along the road to Cochabamba. There's a sort of uneasy calm at this point for Semana Santa, which is a big holiday in Latin America. The union leaders are back in the Chapare area after breaking off negotiations with the government, and there will be a series of different meetings throughout the weekend in different places throughout the Chapare region to make decisions about what steps they will take next.
In terms of numbers, we received reports that anywhere between four and eight people have been killed in the violence. What can you tell us about, in terms of casualties, what the numbers are and what's been going on in that respect?
In the Chapare region, the number we can get confirmed the most readily at this point is at least 7 people have died during the confrontations. At least two of the cases, it's unclear whether they died of lack of being able to receive medical treatment for medical problems that they had before the confrontations began. Yesterday, a group of human rights workers, including a member of the Andean Information Network, went into Chapari to try to get more concrete numbers. They have yet to come back out, and so the numbers that we have are still vary. One of the things that COCA leaders are saying in the area is that a number of people have disappeared, and so it's unclear whether those people are wounded, whether those people are in hiding, or whether those people may, in fact, be other people who were killed during confrontations.
Mm-hmm. Lee, maybe you can give us quickly a kind of a background as to the nature of the general strike, because there's, of course, the question of wages for a number of sectors in Bolivia, but there's also the coca grower situation. And then I also want Leslie to kind of give us some background on that as well. What is the nature of the strike that's going on right now?
Well, the strike that's going on right now is a nationwide strike called by the COB, which is the Central Obrera Boliviana, which is an umbrella organization of a number of unions that exist in Bolivia. And their demands are, among other things, wage increases for a number of the sectors. There's been an incredible amount of problems in Bolivia related to El Nino. There's about to be a huge deficit of food in the country. And so a number of the campesino sectors have joined in the strike, demanding that the government look for solutions to the problems that they're facing in the countryside. The cocaleros, who are one part of the COB unions, have made clear their demands. One is that the government comply with the agreement that they signed last October 17th, where COCA leaders and the government sat down and reached an agreement that they would eradicate the number of hectares needed last year to reach the U.S. demands, but that the government needed to put a serious effort into looking for alternative development for the region, including the development of an agro-industrial complex in the area. To date, the government has done absolutely nothing to comply their part of an agreement that they signed last October. This has been one of the Cocaleros' demands. Another demand is that they be involved in negotiations around the five-year plan that the government released in January of this year, which is an overall comprehensive plan dealing with the issue of narco trafficking in the country, but is very much focused in on the Cocaleros as the source of the problem in the country. And as farmers, they resent that, and they also want to be involved in the negotiations around this plan that to date is still a plan, not a law in the country. And the third point is that the compensation, which Bolivia has always had compensation for hectares of coca eradicated, the compensation is being changed from being an individual compensation to being a community-based compensation, and it's very unclear how that community-based compensation will work, as well as the compensation itself is being reduced from $2,500 per hectare to it's a grade of reduction down over the next 4 years.
Okay. Lee Cridlin is the coordinator of the Andean Information Network based in Cochabamba. We're also joined by Leslie Gill, a professor of anthropology at American University. And Leslie, there's a lot to talk about based on what Lee just laid out, but just a little bit of background on the COB and the general strike. This is the third general strike that's being coordinated since Hugo Banzer took over as president. How effective have the unions in Bolivia been to kind of raise its demands and accomplish some things?
Well, Mario, in Bolivia, as you know, for over a decade, has been undergoing a series of draconian free market reforms that have been driving more people into poverty. And perhaps the most dramatic example of that was the closing of many of the state-owned tin mines in the 1980s, which really devastated the not only the mining communities, but the miners' union, which was the most militant union within the COB. Since then, the coca growers and also public school teachers have really come to the forefront of the popular movement and have been quite outspoken, not only in expressing the demands of peasants in the coca-growing regions, but also of public sector workers who have been increasingly pressed by downsizing and so forth.
Now, the government in Bolivia is saying that the head of the coca growers cannot participate in the discussions, any future discussions at the negotiating table. That's, I guess, the reason why they left the negotiating table in the first place. What how is this going to be received, Leslie? What do you think about that, that the coca growers are now being looked at as straight-up criminals that do not even warrant a seat at the table?
Well, it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, as I was saying, as these free market reforms have driven Bolivians in general deeper into poverty, they become more of a threat to elite concepts of order, and particularly peasants and people who have come to rely on the revenue from coca to support themselves. All this talk of demilitarization that we hear about in the post-Cold War era is really a myth. I think what's happening in Bolivia is that the military is searching for a new mission for itself. It would very much like to be involved in combating the drug traffic. But to a certain extent, and after listening to some of Lee's comments, that this may very much be changing. But I think to a certain extent, it has been precluded from playing more of a role, not only because of the involvement of many in the military high command in drug trafficking, but also because of the militancy of the coca growers and because there's a lot of civilian pressure for the military not to be involved. So I don't think that Bolivians in general are going to look very favorably on keeping Evo Morales out of these talks.
Mm-hmm. Lee, do you want to add anything to that? And maybe we can look specifically at the failure of the government to address it, because this is not unlike what's happened in other countries where the issue of coca eradication has really affected the campesinos, the workers, the poor peasants in, throughout the countryside. Like in Colombia, the same thing has happened where the coca growers have made agreements to try to eradicate the crops themselves, but also with the understanding that the government would provide subsidies for alternative crop development, for marketing possibilities, expanding marketing possibilities for other crops, et cetera, et cetera. What has the government said about their failure to do that?
Well, I think one thing it's interesting to note is Evo Morales is not only the leader of the Cocaleros, but he's actually an elected representative to the Bolivian Congress at this point. And part of the desire to eliminate him from the talks comes from a strategy on the part of the government that's been going on for a number of years here to demonize the coca leaders. They've done a very strong propaganda campaign in the country saying that the cocaleros themselves at the base level want alternative development, want all these things, but it's the dirigentes, it's the leaders in the Chapari area that keep them from participating in projects, that they're forced to march, that they're forced to go out and block roads, which we as an organization that travel into the area with frequency have never seen evidence of, but that has always been part of the propaganda of the country. I think in thinking about Bolivia in contrast with Peru and Colombia, it's important to remember Bolivia is much, much more dependent on the United States. And that is where sort of our role and my particular role as a U.S. citizen living in Bolivia come in that the sense that the United States is really puts pressure on Bolivia and is able to do that because of Bolivia's debt structure, so that Bolivia really has to just jump when the U.S. government says jump. So I think there's a difference in that sense. I think as far as alternative development, at least as far as the experiences I've had in seeing it, there are some small projects that are working in the Chapari, but it is a large area. It's an area that the soils are not very good in because it's a tropical area. And Bolivia still is a very poor country and has an incredible problem with infrastructure. For months, the road into Chapari, the main road into Chapari to Santa Cruz, has been in very, very bad shape due to heavy rains. So there's a big problem in getting, even if you can grow an alternative crop, there's a big problem in getting it out of the country and into international markets, and sometimes even a big problem getting it out of the Chapari region and doing the three-hour trip into Cochabamba. So there's a lot of very sort of small logistical problems with alternative development. There's also a problem in general, which is the cocaleros, because of how I explained earlier, the government's campaign to demonize them, have never been able to participate in projects. They have never been able to make their voice heard and how projects should be developed. They've never been able to be able to be participants. So it's never been a development that's been part of a community movement or part of a community-based plan. It's always been something that's been imposed on top of them. And that's something that they resent and something that for years the Cocaleros have been saying, we need to be involved in all aspects of alternative development plans. But because of the politic of not only the Bolivian government, but also the U.S. government, that's always been forbidden because they are so-called narco-traffickers.
I wanted to ask you, Leslie, on something that Lee pointed out about the U.S. role in Bolivia. President Banzer, in the last couple of days, actually warned that he would impose a state of emergency to deal with the issue of the general strike and the Cocaleros. And, of course, given his past, his nefarious past, what dangers is there of Bolivia returning to this kind of overt, militarist, repressive model?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think the point that you were kind of suggesting in your question, that Bolivia is really a nominal democracy, is actually a very good one. Hugo Banzer was trained at the U.S. School of the Americas, and I think just given his actions so far in repressing the coca growers, I really don't think that he would hesitate to continue with those kinds of policies. Another thing I'd also like to point out is that when Banzer ruled the country after a military coup for most of the 1970s, which was a time that the cocaine industry was developing in lowland Bolivia, he turned a blind eye to this at that time. And in fact, many of his political supporters who were themselves becoming involved in drug trafficking were receiving large grants from the Banzer administration, ostensibly for the purposes of growing sugar cane, cotton, or producing cattle, but then using these estates to manufacture cocaine paste or as airstrips to fly drugs out of the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, what role does the United States play, given the training that he has received? Does the United States play a heavy hand on him, or they basically have the man that they need right there in Bolivia right now?
Oh, yes. I think they're very happy that Banzer won the elections. And as you know, the U.S. has been training a militarized police force, the Leopardos, to proceed with the eradication of coca in the Chapare region. And the Umopar, or the Leopardos as they're also known, is pretty much directly responsible or answerable to the U.S. Embassy, although it also has ties with the military.
Finally, Lee Cridland, what do you see happening in the next couple of days, next couple of weeks, as the tension in Bolivia continues to mount?
Unfortunately, I don't see a whole lot of movement on the part of this government. They have very clearly stated that the five-year plan is not negotiable. They have very clearly stated that the compensation decreases is not negotiable. And they have stated that Evo Morales will no longer be participating as a member of the COP. The situation in the country is desperate, I think, at this point. And I fear that once again there'll be blockades into the Chapare region, and no longer will people be able to get in there. It sounds like from news reports that huge numbers of military and police have been moved into the area. I don't see a goodwill on the part of this government to negotiate, and that's one of the things that I think is worrying us as well as other human rights groups in the country, as well as international human rights groups. Today, Amnesty International sent a letter to the president of the country asking him to respect human rights within the international convenios that Bolivia has signed, those types of things. And we are certainly asking people to pressure the Bolivian government to engage in dialogue. On the other hand, nobody wants people to continue to suffer in this thing. So I think we're going to have to see. Monday they're saying they'll return to roadblocks, they'll return to marching in the streets, and we'll have to see what happens. But at this point, it does. The government here does not seem to be very willing to negotiate. A marked contrast to the last government, which was under under Goni, who seemed to be very willing to sit and negotiate and sign lots of convenios. They never fulfilled their promises, but they were at least willing to go to the negotiating table. So it's a little different politic at this point, and we'll have to see how it plays out. And as you said, the threat of an estado de sitio still exists within the country, and I think that decision will be made Monday or Tuesday, depending on what happens not only with the Cocaleros, but also, as Leslie was saying, with the teachers union, who have been having huge demonstrations in the city of La Paz.
Lee Cridland is the coordinator of the Andean Information Network based in Cochabamba, Bolivia. We were also joined by Leslie Gill, a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. In other news, the leader of the second largest guerrilla force in Colombia is dead. Manuel Perez, a defrocked Spanish priest who became the leader of Colombia's National Liberation Army, or ELN, has died at the age of 62. Perez, a native of Spain who for decades led the ELN, died on February 14th of hepatitis at a jungle hideout. The delayed announcement of his death was made by jailed rebel leader Francisco Galán on April 6th. President Ernesto Samper praised Perez for recently approving negotiations to establish a framework for peace talks, negotiations which once again were put off by the ELN in late March. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI, Pacifica Radio, in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. NACLA publishes a bi-monthly journal, Report on the Americas, and its latest edition has a full report on Colombia. If you want more information, you can call them at 212-870-3146. That's 212-870-3146. And send us an email with comments or questions at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.